This is Spencer Chase at the 84th National FFA Convention, and we're here talking to Dave Reaver, who just spoke at the first general session of the 84th National FFA Convention. Dave, can you tell us a little bit about the message that you just shared with the National FFA members?
Well, I shared a message of what I hope is relevant, being that I ceased all mental development after the age of 19. I think like a teenager, and I really mean that. At 64 years old, I am just coming into my stride. And when I say that, it's because of the opportunities that have been provided for me. I do a lot of schools. I do a lot of military events, especially in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Now, I don't go to Saudi Arabia anymore. We're through there, but that's where I started. And in all my tours and all the work that I do with young people, I still have a young mind. And when I speak to these kids, the key word is relevance. I have to be relevant. And if I don't have relevance in my discussion, it's a monologue, but it's a discussion because they feed back to me in their laughter or in their sobriety. Some points I make are deadly serious. And so it is a conversation with an audience. And it was a very good conversation tonight. I just had a blast.
And it definitely was a very good conversation. And can you just give us a little bit about your background and what inspired you to tell the message that you did tell tonight?
Well, when I was injured in Vietnam in 1969 and half my skin was blown off me, also was over half my face, cutting down across my forehead and then across my nose and then down across this lower lip and across the lower chin, that entire, slightly over half my face was taken down to the bone. It was mutilated. Kids have a serious, serious problem with self-image. And I came through it. I got over that self-image crap, pardon my language. I got over it because how I look isn't near as important as who I am. And who I am, Dave Reaver, stands for the right to be all that you can be, without the Army if you choose. That's the slogan with the Army. So in essence, my first openings of public discourse, as I say, with an audience, it was all about helping with self-image, but it's changed over the years. Now it's come down to serious, serious issues, moral issues, if I can use that word, scare some people to death, but issues that are so urgent in their lives. For instance, we've got them in the military. They're just coming out of high school. Their average age of the U.S. military man in Iraq and Afghanistan is 19 years old. That's average. It's better than Vietnam. We were 18 on an average. We had 17-year-old boys over there fighting that war. They had no business being there fighting that war at that age. I think the average age ought to be 30 and have some maturity set in that experience is brought. But by and large, the real problem is they get in the Army, Air Force, Marines, Navy, and they're no more prepared for what they're being required of. They're not ready. They've sat and played video games. They think they know how to shoot a gun because they played a video game and blew somebody's head off. Think about what I'm saying. They get in the military, and all of a sudden, they've got a sergeant out there, a drill sergeant, that's giving them H-E-double-L for everything they do wrong, and it's everything they do is wrong. And they make it sure that everything they do is wrong. That's their job, is to make sure that young recruit does everything wrong so he can totally restart him on a mentality of uniform. Uniform in behavior, uniform in looks, uniform in clothing, uniform in training, and they're not ready for it. And so my job right now is I speak in schools to help bring a reality check into their lives. Long answer. Sorry.
No, definitely no problem at all. And you mentioned some of the work that you've done in the Middle East. Why do you feel it's important to reach out to boost the self-esteem of not only people in America, but also the Middle East?
Well, the people in the Middle East that I work with are Americans. I don't work with the Iraqis, and I don't work with the Afghanis. Now, I've worked with them in the sense that I interface with them, but they're not my target audience. The Department of Defense contracts me as a resiliency coach in the Comprehensive Soldier Training Fitness Program. And that Comprehensive Soldier Fitness includes not just physical fitness, but a resiliency in spiritual things, a resiliency in their marriage, a resiliency in all their five pillars, in all the things that they have identified as the foundation upon which a good soldier can operate. We have to build up those pillars. Well, my pillar is the emotional and spiritual. So when I go into Afghanistan and Iraq, which I've done six tours downrange, and that's Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar. I went through the list a while ago. But six times five times into Iraq and one into Afghanistan. I'm leaving again soon for Afghanistan, one to Kuwait, and all the other small countries that are part of our coalition. With that said, I have the best job in the military, have the best job in the world, because I focus strongly on suicide prevention. It is the number one issue in the United States military. Kids come home, they get all strung out on Oxycontin, they get drugs from the VA, from the Army, and I'm not saying any of that critically. They're doing everything in their power to help these kids with these drugs. But then the kids themselves, and I call them kids because they're so young, they are abusing those, and they're working the system. And when they come to me, so many of them are just tortured by these drugs. And it's my job to help them see, stick to the prescription, break free from the abuse, look with hope toward a future, and I'll teach you how to get up and make a living and make millions if you'll listen to me. And we don't charge them. It's all free. Everything is free to that warrior. Not a penny. He doesn't even buy a Coca-Cola at the airport. He brings me any kind of receipt, and I'll pay for everything. And that's everything. Airline tickets, curriculum, housing, food, everything. Transportation in any degree.
Yes, definitely. And you mentioned the work that you do with the overseas soldiers, and you also made a repeated reference in your speech to your warriors, whether it was young warriors or wounded warriors. Can you give us a little more background on that?
Yeah. It's Wounded Warriors Alliance. We're not a project. A project is fine. You do a project, you build them a house, or you build them or pay for a house payment, get them a nice car or whatever, or a van that has all the stuff necessary for them to drive. That's all great. That's a project. When the project's over, they're finished. What about the long term? What about the permanence of a relationship? We're an alliance, and an ally is not something that's there for today. It is your ally for life. And I mentor for life. I introduced a young warrior. He's my warrior on the war on drugs. He wasn't even injured in the war, but I saw him as a warrior to take on the drug problems in the public schools. But I have hundreds of warriors that have been through our program, and we're university status. They leave my program with one full semester, 12 college credit hours, and they're able to move right on into Harvard or anywhere else they want. We have a relationship with Colorado State University, Southwestern University for theological studies for those that want to go into ministry, because our key focus, not our only, but our key, is public speaking. Because you don't have to have an arm to speak. You don't have to have legs to talk. You can make a million. You can do it. And we're teaching them how. We help them form their own corporations. We help them select their executive board of directors. Their 501c3 is put through our lawyers, or the lawyers we recommend. And we help them with the FFA's best presentation of Robert's Rules of Order.
So how many warriors, so to speak, have you helped through this alliance?
Well, there's several hundred right now. And I would have to go through, because I've had two sessions. I don't have the collection of numbers yet, but it's probably around 250. It'll be real close to that.
Wow, so definitely making an impact. And yes, and you mentioned in your speech that you are definitely a huge fan of FFA. Definitely, you called yourself its best public servant.
Public relations. I am. Let me tell you, man, FFA to me is the embodiment of the best program, extracurricular activity in a public school system that teaches as much as the school system does. These guys and gals learn more through FFA or as much as they do in anything else, reading, writing, and arithmetic. You know what I'm saying? FFA also embodies, and this is a major word, honor. I've never come across any program in any public school that has more honor integrated into it unless it is the junior ROTC. And when they move out of junior ROTC and go into university system into the ROTC, I guarantee you, from what I've seen, about half of them are FFA students. And so I'm very, very, very involved with FFA. Wherever I go, schools call me. 90% of the time, it's the ag department calls and says, we heard you at the state convention, or we heard you at the national. Would you come speak at our school, and what's your fee? I tell them, here's my fee, and if you don't have the money, I'll pay it. You know, that's what I tell them, because I'm not going to let money stand between me and being successful with these students.
Definitely. So definitely showing a positive example of putting the message ahead of the profit, so to speak.
Yeah.
And you've been speaking for a very, very long time. What has been your favorite memory of speaking, whether it's an FFA engagement or just speaking for another organization?
Wow. Now, that question puts me back on my haunches a little bit. What would I say on that? Because truly, FFA is the most inspirational thing I do. Of any inspirational presentation, I enjoy FFA. But I was in Saddam's palace at Camp Victory, or I think it was Victory or Liberty or one of the palaces. And, of course, it's taken over by the troops. And while I was there, the palace had about 20, 25 warriors that were my bodyguards. They are the guys that surround me everywhere I go, and they fly in the helicopters with me. They protect me. And I think one of the most inspirational moments of my life was talking to them and to see the depression of war. It's incredibly depressing. And the obsession with death. You can't get it out of your mind. It's there 24/7. You sleep it, dream it, eat it, think it. And to see the hope that came over their faces as I spoke. And the laughter, because I like to mix humor into what I do. And it's not jokes. I'm not a joker. If you listen to me, if I have two opportunities to joke with a crowd, 98 times I will see the humorous side of an actual event. And it's how you look at life that makes the difference. And so it's going to be FFA first, and my tours with the military, which includes so many FFA students. You wouldn't believe all the guys that come to me, and girls too. And they say, "You spoke at our national FFA. I was there. I love you." And I say, I just almost break out in tears.
Well, this has been, you know, obviously a very eye-opening experience, you know, from the moment when the grenade went off in Vietnam up until this point. But I can see that, you know, this is, at times this must be a difficult story to tell because there's a lot that goes into this. So what motivated you to really tell this story in the very beginning?
Actually, telling the story was my good medicine. The more I talked about it, the less post-traumatic stress I carried. I don't call it post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't use the D word. And I spoke at Walter Reed Hospital before they changed over a few months ago. I spoke for the last sunrise service. And 85-year tradition, I had the privilege of being the closer. And the attorney, I mean, the guy that's the top doc, I call him. He's the medical general for the U.S. Medical Services. And it'll come to me in a minute. I'm having a brain freeze here.
Attorney General.
No, is in the in medicine, and he was there, and I told him, I said, "Do you find it out of the box to hear me say today that the D word should not be used? It should, because it is a self-fulfilling prophecy, and whenever you say to someone you're disordered, you have post-traumatic stress disorder, that they start living in that mentality of a disordered life." He said, "No, I don't think you're out of the box at all." He said, "We're reviewing it." Now, I believe they have already done it. And I think even in the realm of medicine in the military, I think they're using it less. They're phasing it out. I don't know. I think. But I found out the answer why that disorder word is used. Because insurance companies will not pay for a warrior to go get help for post-traumatic stress independent of the military. Because if it's not a disorder, it's not a sickness. It's just stress. Everybody has stress. You have to be disordered to get insurance. I was told that by an insurance executive. So I'm guessing that that's probably true. I did not deal with post-traumatic stress very long because while I was still a patient, American Medical Association came and did a convention in Brook Army Medical Center, and I spoke for it. They asked me to. And I was very successful at it. They got so excited they asked me every time. Then I start sneaking out of the hospitals on Sundays. I speak in churches. And then I wouldn't come back till Monday afternoon because I spoke in a school on Monday. And no kidding, I was written up AWOL so many times because you're still on active duty as long as you're in that hospital. Until you're stamped and phased out and go to the VA, you're still active duty. They finally said, "Oh, quit writing him up. When he comes back, he's better than when he left." And that was what was happening. I was talking about callousing my spirit, callousing my soul, callousing the pain. Like playing the guitar. You want to play a good, be a good guitar picker? You have to work through a lot of pain. And when the calluses get there, then it doesn't hurt to play. And it doesn't hurt to play anymore.
So just to kind of finally summarize things up, if you were to give a piece of advice to, let's say, a 16 or 17-year-old high school student, whether FFA member or not, and just summarize it up in one word, what would it be?
Wow. I have a word for myself. And if I'm going to be transparent, I need to pass that word on. You know that little dash between the day you're born and the day you die? That's the most important graphic on that tombstone. It's not the date of birth. or the date of death. It's that little dash that gets no attention. That's your whole life, that little dash. What do you want that whole life to be? What do you want your dash to say? When I die, I don't intend to be laid out to rest with my hands across my chest and my fingernails have never been so clean from the musical Porgy and Bess. I want to fly a plane upside down through a barn. You know, I want to do something exciting. I want to go to heaven with blisters on my feet and hair on fire because I went through hell to get there. I don't want to be forgotten before I die. I want to go out in a world of flames. I want to do something special. Make 10 teenagers can't feel my shoes. I want to do something. What is the most important thing then that I can do? It's one word. Others. O-T-H-E-R-S. And if I live my life right and I keep others before myself, that little dash will be something of huge significance to the human race. You cannot live a selfish life and be missed or loved and loved whenever you're gone. You must live a life giving constantly to others. It's the only way I can live.
All right. Thank you very much, Dave. That was Dave Reaver, the keynote speaker for the first session of the 84th National FFA Convention. I'm Spencer Chase.